Dr. Lynn, it doesn't seem like it's been 15 years.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
I bet that 15 years has passed pretty fast for you.
Well, it has been pretty interesting, I have to say, Charlie. Thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to share, especially since so much has occurred. It's actually been 17 years for me, because 2 years before the mass sighting, I had a very close sighting to our home, and you know, captured pictures of it, and I keep going back to that original sighting because I saw these orbs, the Phoenix lights, up close and personal, and you know, nobody can ever take that away. And I got 35 millimeter photographs that cannot be explained or denied, even though I've gone to extreme lengths for the past 15 years since the mass sighting to have them explained to me. So yes, a lot has happened, and I don't know if your listeners are aware. I know you know that I pushed my entire professional successful medical career aside for 4 years after the mass sighting, the 313-97 sighting, where thousands of people were seeing what I had been seeing right over their heads. I mean, a mile to 2 mile wide span of these orbs that seemed to be attached to something, or actual craft. There were many things going on. Traversed right over their heads, rooftop level, about 30 miles an hour, totally silent. It was very eerie for many people because it didn't even displace the air around it, not a sound. And some people actually reported seeing this object and craft, or these lights that seemed to be attached to something, take off at a tremendous speed. Others saw these orbs detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and then redock with it. Incredible technology, to be sure. And this happened throughout the entire state. There's so much mis and disinformation out there the last 15 years, I have to tell you, Jerry. And that was one of the main reasons I came forward after 7 years of anonymity and really trying to do my homework in a credible way, looking for a logical explanation, which I have yet to find, but compiling a 750-page journal of very credible data that I went to great lengths to find, and of the history of these phenomena, of the worldwide sightings that have been happening for not only decades but centuries, and other countries are much more open to these phenomena as being unearthly, these anomalous aerial phenomena, and so on. There is so much data, and finally came forward in 2004, squeezed the best of what I compiled in the 750-page journal down to 230 pages, and actually came forward about a year and a half ago with an update of what has happened since I came forward in 2004, with some stunning data that the people are just starting to hear about. We can talk about that if you'd like.
Yeah, well, I want to find out about all of that. You've kind of summed up 15 rapid years rapidly.
But it's interesting. I mean, Jerry, it's so interesting to learn how the story unfolded. And many people, if they haven't read my book, The Phoenix Lights, The Skeptic's Discovery, that we are not alone, or we're here locally to see how the media played it out and different events happened here locally, are pretty unaware of what really happened here. Because after the mass sighting, we're talking thousands of people. And again, there wasn't just one or two events, as the media or debunkers would have us think. There were many events for many, many hours. We actually have reports as early as 3 p.m. daylight sightings of these phenomena on March 13th, to as late as 5:30 the next morning, when a Boeing crew was coming into the airport for work and saw one of these objects hovering right over the tarmac at Sky Harbor International Airport. It's amazing when you really start to put the puzzle pieces together and connect the dots. The story is fascinating because on March 13th itself, not only were there orb formations, not only were there crafts, and by the way, if your listeners would like to get on the website, the Phoenix Lights Network website, it is just chock full of information, credible information, authenticated photographs on the photo page, which is one of the reasons I had to come forward, actually, because I, in good conscience, I couldn't stick this data in a drawer. If it's important, it needs to be out there. And also the GAP page, G-A-P, which is a geospatial animation project, which was compiled a 12-year compilation of hundreds of reports from the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, Arizona MUFON, Village Labs, which is a clearing, local clearinghouse here in Tempe, as well as a thousand reports from Frances Barwood, Councilwoman Frances Barwood, who was the only elected official at the time to come forward to even ask for an investigation, and that wasn't until May, and she got plastered to the wall, and the sighting was March 13th. Also, there was no investigation. I mean, it was really bizarre, Jerry. I mean, when you start to look at what happened after the mass sighting itself, so many thousands of people, over 10,000 people at least, were touched very deeply, and we can get into that if we have time, by this sighting. And yet, there was no investigation. There was no explanation. In fact, all of the governmental officials were like saying, well, did something happen on March 13th? And we know some of them even saw it, which we'll get to. But at any rate, it was weird. I mean, it really was, because even a public safety issue, to have these phenomena at such low altitude. I mean, we're talking rooftop altitude. Some people said they could have thrown a rock at it. It was so close. Some had the huge wells of light right above them. It's so interesting to hear their description. At any rate, there was nothing happening until months later, June 18th, a USA Today article front page brought our mass sighting to international attention almost immediately. It was uncanny. I mean, overnight, every morning show, every news program was talking about it. We were deluged by media from all over the world asking, once they spoke with the witnesses and their testimony was so heartfelt and so detailed, why isn't there an investigation? Why isn't there an explanation? And the very next day, and this is how this unfolded, the very next day, on June 19th, former Governor Fife Symington called a press conference, a unscheduled press conference, to reveal the culprit of the March 13th incident. And people took it seriously. The media took it seriously. And here he comes marching out, one of his aides, in a giant alien head costume, and making a mockery of the sighting, which really offended many, many people, particularly parents who were with children, who knew that something extraordinary had gone over them. And yet, you know, here the governor was making a joke out of the whole thing. At any rate, it wasn't for another month before we would hear the official explanation, and it's interesting how that unfolded too, Jerry, because I really tried to do my homework. I mean, besides taking my photographic data to the University of Arizona Optical Science Department, Consciousness Study Department, ASU, Arizona State University, Geology, Anthropology, Mathematics, Astronomy Departments, as well as the renowned Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara, and Navy optical physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee, and others, you know, I have to tell you, I mean, nobody could give me an answer. I mean, all they could do was tell me what it wasn't. But on the other side, too, I really tried to do my homework with the military. I was looking for a logical explanation for what I witnessed and photographed up close and personal. And they were more interested in seeing what I had documented on film and giving an explanation for it. I have to tell you, I have some of the conversations with the military in my book, and it's quite comical. I mean, they had no idea. They were just as curious as the rest of us what this was. And here I receive a call 1 month after the USA Today article on July the 24th from the head of the PR at the Air National Guard stating, oh, Dr. Lynn, I think we know what those lights were back in March. And I was thrilled. I said, you do? What were they? And she said, well, do you believe that nobody ever looked at the log for all these months, and the Maryland Air National Guard was in town sending off flares in Operation Snowbird, which I have come to learn from military insiders means diversionary tactical maneuver. So, Jerry, I don't doubt that flares may have been sent off somewhere, but I have to tell you, in 15 years, I have not had one, and I'm pretty intimately involved with this investigation.
Yes, you are.
I have not had one person give me any kind of description that comes close to what flares look like. But anyway, she says, that must be what some people saw. Well, the first question I had, I said, well, you know, when was the Air National Guard in town? She says March 1st to the 15th. And I said, so were they in town in January? She says, oh, no. I said, are you sure? She said, absolutely not. I said, well, I have 35-millimeter pictures of the same exact phenomena that I captured on March 13th on video in the same exact location, confirmed by air traffic controllers as hovering 1,000 feet altitude in Class B restricted airspace, turning against the wind and moving as a unit behind South Mountain. And she says, well, you never told me that. And then I said, and besides, I said, you're trying to say, and I had educated myself to any logical explanation, including flares, I said, you're trying to say that flares that cannot keep a formation, that drift and drop with the wind, and illumination flares not only illuminate the smoke trails coming, you know, billowing from the flare itself, but they illuminate the area around it. Not one person described that. And you're trying to tell me that illumination flares that cannot keep a rock-solid formation, equidistant formation for hours throughout the state? And she said, oh, I have a call coming in. I'll get back to you. I'm still waiting. Anyway, they came out with the announcement the next morning when it was headlines in the papers here, that the Phoenix lights were military illumination flares. Well, talk about deflating any kind of hope that we'd find out what these things were, because anybody that saw the real deal knew that they weren't military flares, okay? But, you know, like myself, I was open. I was looking for any logical explanation. And if they're flares, okay, let's reenact it. I mean, I knew that I had photographs. Now, this is where it really gets interesting, Jerry, and we're going to go back to the 95 sighting in a second. But I have photographs, and if you look on the photo page, you know, in science we look for repeatability, and these things keep showing up in the same spot, and if you look at it, it speaks for itself. I have photographs of the same exact phenomena appearing in the same exact location, not only 2 months before the mass sighting, when the air traffic controllers also confirmed that it was 1,000 feet altitude in Class B restricted airspace, but 2 years before, if you look at those photos, when I was capturing the close orbs, the same exact phenomena is in the background there as well. So whoever did this did it at least three times, and I have them subsequently as well. But at the time, you know, I thought, geez, you know, I have it three times. Somebody did it three times. Mm-hmm. Do it again. Well, it wasn't until right before the third anniversary of the mass sighting. And by the way, not only was Councilwoman Frances Barwood plastered with jokes and comics in the paper and so forth, just innocently asking at a council meeting in May if, you know, they could look into it, because so many of her constituents, she was doing her job, so many of her constituents had called to ask why there wasn't an investigation. And she actually was running at the time for Secretary of State on a platform to get answers for the Phoenix Lights event, and pushing for a reenactment as well, publicly. And suddenly we get the word, big time, in the radio, on TV, in the news, and in the paper, that three Air National Guards were coming into town to deploy flares and show everybody the Phoenix Lights. They're going to reenact the Phoenix Lights. And I have to say that a lot of people were very excited about this, because finally we were going to have an answer. And hey, you know what? If it was them and they did it, I mean, shame on them that they didn't admit it for so long. Shame on them that the story changed about, you know, a half a dozen times at least, about planes being in the air and not being in the air. And shame on them if they went over people's heads and then denied that anything happened for months. But hey, if it's military, do it again. Well, if you get on the news page on the Phoenix Lights Network and take a look at the report, it says Arizona Family 3, you'll see the footage of their flare drop.
No comparison, really.
I mean, it really was such a failure for them.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to do a 2-week run, and they ended up scrapping it the second day because anyone that had seen the real deal knew unequivocally that it wasn't the Slayers.
So many things happened there, and we want to get into some of the details about it here in a minute, but since this period, you say you have evidence that things like that was happening before the mass sighting.
Mm-hmm.
Has it been happening recently?
Actually, they've been happening for centuries. I mean, if you really look at the data, not only do you find, you know, in primitive caves in Pakistan and elsewhere, you're going to find that there are long extinct animals etched out on the walls of these caves with UFOs in the sky. I mean, this is, you know.
And that's down in South Mountain, right?
Well, that's another. I'm so glad you brought that up because, absolutely. I mean, what really got me, and there were so many coincidences that happened even right before the mass sighting, that I've come not to believe in coincidences. That we can get into some of them, but I have to tell you, 6 months before the mass sighting, and this will answer your question. I was asked to present my substance abuse prevention education program. I've been, what's ironic about this, Jerry, and my part in this, and why I came forward as well, to, you know, if I can use my expertise to lend some credibility to this topic, how can I not? But I've been doing community education for the past 35 years. And, on vital health issues. So when this fell in my lap, and I had to educate myself first, but how could I not do it for this vital issue? Because, it's just so important. And I was invited to present my substance abuse prevention education program. I have a company that produces, video and workbook curriculums on AIDS and teen pregnancy and substance abuse prevention education, and at the Gila River Indian Reservation, which is actually situated in between South Mountain and the Estrella Mountain Range. There's a basin in between, and if you look at my photo page, you'll see that there's the first picture is the topography from our vantage point, and you can see that on the left side there's South Mountain, and then there's a basin, and some miles back are the Estrella Mountain Ranges, and they intersect at one point, and that's right where the Gila River Indian Reservation is, which is very sacred ground. At any rate, they have one school, and I went to the school, and I got friendly with them. They usually don't really share with outsiders, but I kept looking at my pictures and noting that these phenomena kept popping up right where South Mountain and the Estrellas intersect. And again, you can look at the data, it speaks for itself, it's right there. And I went back to them and I said, did anybody see strange lights on March 13th? And they started to giggle. And I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding me? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky people, light beings. It's part of their culture. I had no idea. I mean, that really blew me away. Not only do they believe, and other indigenous cultures worldwide believe, that there are other intelligences, and some of them believe that they're spirit world coming, these orbs coming to give them guidance and inspiration and comfort. And, it blew my mind. And then they started telling me about the petroglyphs in the mountains, as you mentioned. And there are petroglyphs. There's actually a petroglyph that really took me aback, because on South Mountain there is a petroglyph of three orbs in a triangle formation, and that's exactly what my husband and I saw in 1995. And there are native cultures right here in Arizona that actually have protocols. And I know there's others worldwide that have protocols to invite these phenomena in. So there are certainly, history and cultures that are very open to these things, and countries. I didn't know that either. And in fact, another coincidence, if I may share this, You know, I had no interest or knowledge in this topic at all. I should say that straight out. Before our closed sighting in 95, neither my husband, who's also a physician, and I had any interest in this. And if anything, I personally shied away from it because of all the scary movies and stories and all that stuff. I just wasn't interested. And, you know, here it falls in my lap. And you know, I was so touched by the experience itself in 95, if you want me to get into that, which was a very close sighting. It was just yards from our home. I mean, here, in fact, it was just a couple weeks ago. It was the night before my birthday, February 6th, that the eve of my birthday is the 7th, and I was leisurely taking a bath, and one wall of our bedroom is a window. We live pretty high mountainside in Paradise Valley and have a panoramic view of the city skyline, so we know what planes look like and helicopters and streetlights and car lights, and we see planes coming into Sky Harbor all the time, and certainly flares occasionally. We see those too, which are very different from the true unknowns, by the way. And suddenly my husband calls me out of the bath, kind of frantic, what the hell is that? And a little below us, because we're pretty high, over very treacherous desert grounds, were three amber orbs in a pyramid formation. One was on top and two were closely aligned underneath. And I immediately looked underneath to see if anything was causing it. And it's a private gated residence and very treacherous. Nobody goes there. It's very steep. And it was totally black. And it was about 50, 75 feet off the ground. And you know, did you ever have a mental moment where you took everything in that you possibly could? Because I didn't want to move. I mean, you hear that over and over again when someone has an unexplained experience. Mm-hmm. You're kind of, you know, just standing there in awe and watching this, and I'm thinking to myself, I've got to take everything in. I can't move. I don't know how long it's going to last. I want to get my camera, but I don't want to miss anything. So I tried to take in the shape, the color, the size, and so forth. They were about 3 to 6 feet each. They were oval-shaped, like an egg on its side. They were three distinct objects, very closely aligned. And the color within each orb, and I call them an orb because the light did not extend outside the edge. The light was totally self-contained and a uniform amber color throughout. And it didn't glare at all. That was one of the characteristics I noted immediately. It didn't glare at all. It was just mesmerizing. Every other light out there glared. And I thought to myself, you know, if I don't get a picture of this, no one's going to believe it. So I ran to the closet to grab my 35 millimeter, which I keep handy to capture beautiful sunsets that we have here in the Phoenix area. And my husband calls me back. He said, get over here quick. One of them is disappearing. And as we both watched, and when I say in awe, I mean, it was just one of the most fantastic experiences I've ever had in my life. I mean, the top orb, without budging from the other two, it didn't waver, it didn't move, it just started to implode. Like, it started to dim, but like an imploding. It's so hard to explain. Very, very...
You mean it closed in on itself?
Yeah, I mean, it started to get smaller and smaller mm-hmm. mechanically. Like there was an intelligence behind it. It wasn't anything natural that you could ever imagine.
Like, you know, turning down the radio volume, only it was visual.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, right. And it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller until it was a dot. And then it went out, but it felt as if it was still there. I mean, it was just uncanny. It was just unbelievable. And, you know, and I have to tell you, I stepped out on the balcony, took a quick picture of the two bottom orbs, and immediately noticed an eerie silence. That was really one of the other bizarre moments of my life. I mean, you couldn't hear a thing. It was just totally, totally bizarre. And, you know, at that point, I took a quick picture of the two lower orbs, and not only noticed the eerie silence, but it felt as intently as I was watching these two lower orbs. It felt that something was watching me. I have to admit that, and I didn't admit it to anybody until after the mass sighting. But going through my mind at that moment, I was thinking, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. And the next thing I remember, the left bottom orb started to disappear. and I saw, and I took a quick picture of that. And that's all I remember, Jerry. I have to tell you, I mean, to this day, I vaguely remember anything else. I don't remember the last light disappearing. I don't really remember going in that night or going to bed, but whatever, it is what it is. And I did have photographic evidence of it. And I will always go back to that because I saw it up close, and it was nothing of this earth.
And now that this happened within a couple of weeks ago.
No, this was in 17 years ago.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I want to make sure we're what we're talking about. Yeah.
1995.
Okay.
That was my first sighting, and I had a... I did have a picture. There was only one that turned out at the time, but the one that turned out was pretty magnificent because it was the one that had just one light there, like half disappeared, as the second one was disappearing, and one still there, which was pretty amazing. I mean, here I have something that, it verifies that something strange did happen, and I have a picture of it, and, what can I tell you? I didn't even know who to show it to, and kept wondering for 2 years what this advanced technology was doing outside our bedroom window. It was just absurd.
Now I want to ask you, because your husband's a doctor too, right?
Yep.
And so both of you are people of science, but here we're talking, and I've noticed in some of your writings, Dr. Lynn, and discussions, that you seem to be gravitating toward, for lack of a better term, a paranormal or spiritual explanation.
Well, you know, all I can do is share the
data. And I'm not putting you down for that. I'm marveling at it.
Share the data, and it is. I mean, that blew me away too, because, you know, I have to tell you. I mean, when you study this information and you really look at what's happened to other people too worldwide, and that was another reason that I had to come forward as a physician. Not only as an experiencer and as a scientist, but as a physician. There are so many people out there, and let's be clear, I mean, most things can be explained. Only a small percentage cannot. And just because we don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are, it doesn't mean they're not real. I mean, look, it took us 17 centuries with the advent of the microscope before we realized that there are zillions of tiny living entities all around us, even in our bodies. Some are pathogens, some are beneficial. We've learned to live with it. And, you know, the same for radio waves and gamma rays and so forth. Just because we can't see them and we don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are, it doesn't mean they're not real. We may just be looking on an AM dial for an FM frequency. So,
yeah.
You know, it's time we get this topic out in the open and we address it and accept it and study it so we can not only find out who's driving these things, but also move forward in our own evolution, because as you mentioned, I mean, these phenomena have touched, and we're not just talking about anomalous aerial phenomena, and I'll get into that in a second, because I found a connection between all unexplained phenomena in my journey to find logical explanation for the Phoenix Lights, that affect people at such a deep level and transform them forever, that it was important for me to come forward as a physician to say you're not crazy. And again, most things can be explained, but when somebody has an anomalous experience, it's real to them. And if you let it fester, particularly many people see things as kids and never tell us all because they're afraid of the criticism or discrediting or whatever, and it's not healthy. It's cathartic to share, and I urge anyone out there that has had an experience that hasn't shared it to share it with just one person. Even if you get on my website, there's a contact at the very top. You can get to my email and just share it with me. And believe me, I've had thousands of those that could have come in the last 15 years, which is fine. It's very, very healing to be able to share it. And you know, having been an experiencer, and for 7 years, I have to tell you, Jerry, for 7 years, I did major soul searching and major searching not only for the logical explanation but what to do with the data. And here I had what might be important information that, you know, in good conscience, how could I stick it in a drawer? And I really, really fought with that for many years. But getting back to how the sighting affected people and how anomalous experiences affect people at a very, very deep level, even in real time, I have to tell you, it's very interesting. This is an interesting anecdote. 6 months before the mass sighting, the movie Independence Day came out. And I have to tell you, we address it in the documentary. We are so inundated and taught that to be fearful and that it's a threat. And I'm not saying everything's benevolent out there, but I do have to say that in 15 years, March 13th, there has not been not one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights. And that's all I can speak for. But that's telling in and of itself. Anyway, in real time, when this phenomenally large, mile to 2 mile wide formation of lights or craft were coming towards, kids, they were jumping up and down, Independence Day, Independence Day. And they were scared. But as it got closer, not only children, but adults as well, a calmness took over them, a sense of connection to the phenomena, and you would hear this over and over and over again. And not everyone, okay, let's be clear. Everybody comes from a different background, from a different upbringing, from a different belief system. Some people can't deal with this. Some people don't want to deal with it, and that's okay. That's okay, everyone in their own time. But those who truly experienced the Phoenix Lights were transformed in real time. I mean, the kids, as it passed over, kids wanted to run after it, and adults wanted to, follow it. I mean, it's so interesting when you see that kind of transformation and change in real time, that this thing, whoever it was, really affected people very, very strongly in real time. And then when I was doing my research, I actually found another connection, which was very interesting. I mean, I had witnesses say to me that they had near-death experiences as children that was reawakened by the mass sighting. And I find that very curious because I did too. And I go into detail about my own childhood near-death experiences in the book, The Phoenix Lights of Skeptics, Discovery That We Are Not Alone. But what I found really poignant is that the thought occurred to me, whoa, if they there, and the same thing happened to me. I mean, my near-death experience that I had buried for over 40 years was reawakened by the Phoenix Lights. Maybe there's a connection between all unexplained phenomena, whether it's near-death experience, out-of-body experience, unexplained aerial phenomena that have a mystical light associated with the experience. And lo and behold, when I started looking again, I started finding such credible data. I mean, besides the whole history with that we can get into with not only primitive caves, but in the Bible and the 15th and 16th century paintings and Foo Fighters, which Dr. Richard Haynes conferred with me on my close sighting and said that, the orbs that my husband and I saw in the rock-solid pyramid formation are identical to what each side was seeing during World War II. And it wasn't everybody thought that somebody had this advanced spy technology. They called them Foo Fighters. And it wasn't until after the war that each side, Germany, Japan, U.S., tried to study these things, and everybody realized there was no spy technology. What was
it?
They've been around, a long, long time. And
Each thought it was the other, and they found out it wasn't any of them.
Exactly. And then when you fast forward and you I have pictures of the Lubbock Lights. I mean, they're so similar, Lubbock Lights, and you have certainly the Hudson Valley triangles in UK and Belgium in the 80s and 90s, and even 1 month before ours, I have video, stunning video, of the same exact craft that people were seeing throughout Arizona was seen and videotaped in St. Petersburg, Russia, 1 month before our mass sighting.
Yeah, I saw that.
February 19th.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. And in fact, that particular one of the videos We now have on the third edition, the latest edition of our documentary DVD cover, because I had mentioned the GAP program, Geospatial Animation Project. There were 8 or 9 different craft that people saw, and this is a compilation of hundreds from reports all over the state. Whether it was one craft that could morph into looking differently, or it was a parade of different craft, or it was the perspective from where the person was standing, we may never know. But it seems from all the reports that there were a lot of things going on. I mean, it wasn't just one or two events, and I really want to get into that because Dr. Bruce Maccabee just reanalyzed essentially the only hard evidence that we have during the mass sighting, and again has reported. He just came out with a report about a month ago. With now that we have state-of-the-art, technology with Google Earth and GPS and so forth, to essentially say what he had said before. But most people didn't read it. And one of the misconceptions, and I just want to make that clear while we're on the topic, is that there were two events. I mean, this is a total disinformation, misconception, whatever, but people obviously have not looked at the data, or they would know better, because there were many events for many, many hours. But what the media and debunkers have grabbed onto is that the earlier sightings, and like I said, they started in the afternoon. So the bulk of the reports, however, came in between 8 and 9:30, something like that, 8 and 10. And that's when most people were outside looking up at the sky at the Hale-Bopp Comet. So that makes sense. And then the videos around 10 o'clock, and there were two of us that caught videos before 10 o'clock, and two boomerang videos after 10 o'clock. And my video is of the three points of light, giant, massive span, like at least a mile wide, of equidistant lights, three lights like the endpoints of a V or triangle, which was described by thousands of people statewide for the previous hours, appeared shortly before 10 o'clock, and by the way, was confirmed the next morning by air traffic controllers again as being in Class B restricted airspace, about 1,000 feet altitude, and then moving as a unit and behind the mountain range. Anyway, Dr. Bruce Maccabee went back to the videos. One of the videos is still being under investigation. But he has now made a report substantiating again, and this is his opinion, that the two boomerang videos are totally different set of lights than mine. Okay? They're at a great distance from Phoenix. He surmises that they're close to the gunnery range and that they are most likely flares deployed by the Maryland Air National Guard. Mine, however, it's a totally different animal, totally different set of lights that is near and over Phoenix, and certainly confirmed to be by the air traffic controllers, is different in configuration and timing and spacing from the boomerangs, and remains unidentified. So in other words, by the way, this was stated in a couple of lines in his very extensive report that he did in 1998 that appeared in the MUFON International Journal that most people don't bother to read. They just assume that all the videos around 10 o'clock are flares. That is not the case. Okay? And now we have substantiation by Dr. Bruce Maccabee, Navy optical physicist, who's very well respected in the field, that shows that my video may be essentially the only hard evidence at this point.
Now, your video, did you shoot that yourself?
Yes. Well, to me, it was another night. To me, it was, I had been, again, just to go back so we understand how the things unfolded, after our closed sighting, again, I knew nobody to even show the pictures to, so I just wondered for 2 years what this advanced technology was doing outside of our bedroom window. And 2 months before the mass sighting, this is 2 years later, 2 months before the mass sighting in January of 97, I noticed three orbs, but this time in a line formation, an equidistant line formation far west. And I just watched them for minutes, and I saw that they were in a formation. they were strangely similar to 95, and that they, even though they were at a distance, and that they were orbs, they were big balls of light that were in a formation equidistant from each other and hovering for minutes. And then they seemed to implode from the outside inwards again, from right to left, like 1, 2, 3, and they were gone. The next night, my husband was at a hospital board meeting. At the time, he was on several state and hospital medical boards. And I happened to notice the same three lights in the equidistant line now were in front of South Mountain. Now, I knew they were in front of the mountain because there are red blinking lights on the highest part of the mountain to alert planes coming into Sky Harbor Airport, which is right in front of just north of South Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And they were lower. They were definitely lower. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get video of this. And I ran out with my video camera, which was fully charged at the time. And I got about 18 seconds worth, and then my battery went dead, which is, I guess, interesting in itself. And I ran in, hooked up the battery, ran out. They were gone. This is about 8 o'clock on January the 23rd, 1997. And I hear my husband come up the drive, and I went outside, and I said, remember I told you about the three lights far north last night in a row? Well, about a half hour ago, they were right in front of South Mountain. And as I'm standing there pointing to where they were, they reappeared in the same spot.
Wow.
Okay? And I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got to get a picture. So here comes another coincidence, and I've come not to believe in coincidence, because your video does not do these lights justice. And anyone that's seen the video, they flicker, they're white, they're much smaller. Whoever thought up the flare idea was brilliant, I have to tell you, because they look much more like flares in the video than they do in real life. In real life, they're huge balls of what seems like energy. At any rate, I was, you know, getting the battery charged for the video, and video is very hard to analyze, but 35 millimeter is terrific to analyze. So even better than digital, because digital, the pixels break up when you try to get close. And I ran upstairs, I grabbed my 35 millimeter, got out on the balcony, and just as I'm ready to shoot the three, suddenly six pop on top of the three. Massive span, equidistant from each other. It was unnerving. And if you look at the photos of the photo page on the phoenixlights.net, you'll see that it's kind of wavy. Well, it's because I'm shaking, I have to tell you. I was shaking. It was unnerving because it was so massive. Not having an explanation from 95, it was like, oh my goodness, is this a mothership or a fleet or what is this? But I started clicking away. And at that point, I got six pictures in a row of this phenomena head-on turning into a V-shape. And you can see it. And actually, the second picture is phenomenal, because if you look at that second picture, you can see one light in the center is brighter than the two on each side. And there's two underneath. There seems to be two orbs underneath. Well, that's exactly, this is 2 months before the mass sighting, but that's exactly what most people would describe during, many, many people would describe, during the mass sighting, five lights in a V formation with two trailing, which, that's a picture of it 2 months before. And then as I continue clicking away, you can see how the object turned. And, you know, what we're looking at, because every other light is bigger than the ones in between, is, and this has, again, been extensively analyzed, is most likely what I captured were these lights either with a field in between, because you could see through it. You could see through to the other side. Or they were separate objects that were just in rock-solid formation. At any rate, you know, that was so unnerving that I did call the next morning. I called around and found the air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor. And, you know, they were more excited than I was, actually. It was really funny, because the guy that I met with, one of the air traffic controllers, is a really mellow guy. And he got on the phone, finally, after I searched someone down that had seen it. And he was more excited than me. He said, did you see the six lights that were equidistant from each other at 8:30 last night? I said, yes, that's why I'm calling. He says, well, there were actually three at 8 o'clock. I said, I saw them, too. And at that point, he says that they were alarmed because they were about 1,000 feet altitude, and over Class B restricted airspace. There's a 30-mile radius around the center of the airport where anyone that comes into that airspace, particularly 1,000 feet altitude, must call into the tower, and nobody called. So they looked at the radar, nothing on radar. They took their binoculars to look, and what they saw, in his own words, were 6 points of light, massive span, totally equidistant from each other, that seemed to be attached to something. People would say that over and over again on March 13th, too, but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to. And this one guy was a meteorologist, and he said it turned against the wind, and I happened to catch pictures as it was happening, and then moved as a unit behind South Mountain. And when I said, so what was it? There was silence, and then finally one of the guys said, beats me. And I said, you're air traffic controllers. You're supposed to know it's in our airspace. They had no idea what it was, and I continued photographing these things up into and including March 13th when the advertisement comes on for the news, I guess about 10 of 10, and my husband and I were in bed already. And there wasn't a thing, by the way, on the news about it, or I would have been prepared with my camera. And suddenly we see six lights pop up on the same location as 2 months before. And by the time I got out there with my camera and got on my robe and got out there and focused the camera, was totally out of focus. I captured the three, like the endpoints of a giant triangle. So, you know, we have confirmation from the air traffic controllers the next morning that not only did they see him again in the same exact location as 2 months before as I had, but a pilot called in on approach to the airport to say, what the hell are these lights over me? There was a lot going on. I mean, there's so much more to this story.
When we talk about these things, it's confusing, I'm sure, to everybody, because we're not really sure if they're real physical objects or some sort of other dimensional thing or whatever. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Jerry, because, you know, having seen the closed sighting, and I have to say, not only did it feel, once these orbs disappeared, that they were still there, but they felt like they were still there for weeks after. I mean, it was really eerie, I have to say. And, you know, now, and I'll get to the closed sighting again, an analysis, Dr. Bruce McAbee also analyzed those pictures. And as an afterthought, actually, I had sent him another sighting that happened a year after the NAS sighting. In fact, I had hired a geological professor from ASU, Arizona State University, to try to triangulate the four videos around 10 o'clock. And he first went to Mike Christen's house. He did the giant boomerang that everybody sees on TV. And he shot his about 10:15 after 10. And then he came to my house, and he said, so you saw yours, you know, after 10 o'clock, quarter after 10, whatever. I said, oh, no. Mine was more like quarter of 10. He said, well, wait a minute. And he says, well, when did the other people capture theirs? And what we realized was that everybody captured their footage at a different time, and they were different looking things. I mean, not mine looks like the 3 points, the end points of a V or triangle. The other one before 10 o'clock is more like an arrowhead. And then the two after 10 o'clock are boomerangs. He says, you can't triangulate these things. It's impossible. They're different things, and they're different times. He said it could have been totally different events. And he actually stormed out. He was quite distraught that he couldn't do the job. So here, a year after the mass sighting, we had another sighting, which was very different. I want to make that clear. Very different from the mass sighting. This time, there were straight lines and mirror images and a giant triangle, like a pyramid, but giant, in the same spot again, I have to say, as a grand finale. But this time I had alerted three other people. I had seen the lights. It was the first time I had seen them through a very thick fog. And we don't have fog here. It was eerie in itself that the weekend you couldn't even see past our street. And my husband would joke, you know, that they could be there watching us. But it was a little bizarre. And suddenly on Monday night, we were outside on the balcony, and I see two of these orbs, very muted because of the fog, appear behind my husband's head, and I thought, oh my goodness, are they back? Because I hadn't seen anything since March 13th, 97, and this was January of 98. And I ran in and took video, and I looked similar on video, but I wasn't sure, and when I had met with the University of Arizona, they had said to me my equipment was very subpar equipment, and they said if these lights come back, you need to get better equipment and professional equipment. So I called them up the next morning, and I told them, I don't know if they're back, but these look similar, although they're muted. What should I get? And I ran around all day the next day, getting a top-of-the-line Pentax camera with a tele-lens and a star filter and all this stuff. And that night they did come back. And I got incredible pictures, by the way, that night. And it just so happened, again, a little coincidence, that we had a meeting the next morning, the third day, at Village Labs. And I shared with them that I had seen the lights the two previous nights. And I just had a feeling that they might be back the third night. So to alert the other videographers. And I have to say, I mean, I really stayed anonymous. There were very, very few people that knew who I was and what I had.
This is before you went public, huh?
Oh, yeah. It took 7 years. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm telling you, a handful of people knew who I was.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I asked them to please contact the other people, and which they did. And there were four of us at four different locations, north, south, east, and west, that captured this 40-mile-wide, 20-minute array of these lights. Again, very different from the mass sighting. In fact, I talk about my conversations with the military the next day, because I called around the next morning to see if anything was going on with the military. And not only did they say that we couldn't see, you know, if they were sending off flares, even though it was foggy, and they probably weren't, you know, we couldn't even see them from our vantage point. But besides that, one of them said laughingly, you know, but he was serious, and I kind of giggled to myself. He said, if you saw a line of flares, 8 or 9 flares, and that was us. I mean, you know, were they trying to cover themselves? I don't know, but that's what he said. This was very different. There was nothing like that in 98. But anyway, I had the videos from north, south, east, and west, and I figured I had heard about Dr. Maccabee, and I had been referred to him by Linda Moulton Howe and a few other people, and I contacted him. And as an afterthought, when I sent the videos, I also sent the first and last picture from 1995, the closed sighting. And he calls me up a couple weeks later, and to answer your question from before, how different people react, from day one, my husband would not talk about it. I mean, he would get agitated when I brought it up. He was inside, I was outside. Did something happen? I don't know. But nonetheless, he would not talk about it. And this is, you know, like 3 years later, Dr. McAvey comes to me and he says, now you told me that the closed sighting was just a few minutes long. I said, that's right. I said, that's what I remember. He said, ask your husband to corroborate. And I said, he won't talk about it. He said, you've got to sit him down and just find out how long that sighting was in 95, which I did. And he confirmed, you know, 3-4 minutes tops. I went back to Bruce, Dr. Maccabee, and told him, and he said, that's impossible. I said, what do you mean? And he said, look at the pictures. And if anybody's near the Phoenix Lights website, Phoenix Lights Network website, you know, if you get on the photo page, you'll be able to see it quite clearly. In the first picture, he says, first of all, there's four lights in a row in the background in the same spot as 2 months before the mass sighting and during the mass sighting. And in the last picture, there's two in the background. So these phenomena were there in the background when we had our closed sighting. So you could speculate, I guess, that, you know, perhaps like people that reported these orbs detaching from the main object, going out in the environment, and then redocking with it, perhaps that's what happened to us in 95. But to go one step further, he says, now look at the skyline. I said, okay. And I would have never, Jerry, I would have never in a zillion years ever noticed this. He said, there's many groups of lights on in the first picture that are off in the last picture. He said, that doesn't happen in 2-3-4 minutes. He said, I'd like you to do an experiment. And he asked me to stand approximately where I was standing in 95 and take a picture of the skyline. Now, this is 3 years later, but take a picture of the skyline and see when groups of lights would start going out. Now, I usually take a bath when we're home between 7 and 8 in the evening. So let's be conservative and say 8 o'clock. My husband called me out of the bath. And the first groups of lights start going out at 9 o'clock. The last picture is indicative of 10:30, 11 o'clock. Now, at the time, I had no idea what he was talking about, could not wrap my head around any of it. He says to me, can I present this case at the upcoming 1999 MUFON International Symposium in Washington, D.C.? And I said, hey, you know, number one, I would have never, ever noticed any of this. This is your baby. You discovered it. And he was very meticulous. If you look at the study, and we have the 21-page report on the Phoenix Lights Network website, I mean, it is just so bizarre. There's just so much more to the story that I couldn't even go there. But he presented it in 1999, and I never told a soul for over a dozen years, as the first authenticated photographic evidence ever. And I have to tell you, I mean, it took me a dozen years to not only decide to come forward with it, but to tell you, even to this day, it is so out there and so bizarre to me that, you know, and I don't remember anything other than what I shared with you, that I don't even go there. But now that quantum physics and quantum mechanics has caught up, and I was asked to actually do another book of what has happened since I came forward, and I don't want to write another book. I think there's too many important things in the first book, and again, it was a 750-page journal that I squeezed the best of what I found into 230 pages. Plus, you know, I have to tell you, I mean, with quantum physics and quantum mechanics now postulating the bubble theory and string theory, that there might be 10 or 11 different dimensions out there, and having experienced the closed orbs myself and feeling that it was interdimensional. They disappeared to somewhere, but felt like they were still there. I mean, that's the only thing that makes sense. That, you know, if there's other times and spaces along with ours, then why is it such a leap to think that there might be other intelligences that we get glimpses of if we're open to them or invited? And, you know, I have to tell you again, Jerry, I have come not to believe in coincidence. You know, at this point, if I have this data, again, how can I stick it in a drawer? Maybe it's important. Maybe it can help open that door a little bit to realize that linear time, past, present, and future, that we believe in so strongly, is not really what time is at all. And that there is so much more of another reality out there that we have yet to appreciate. So that's why I'm sharing that data now, if people care to look at it. And I certainly, again, hope that scientists will take a look at it. I mean, it is what it is.
Now, let's talk about what is available for people to investigate that you've done. Things that are available. You have the documentary. You have the book. Tell me a little bit about what all you have out there.
Well, first of all, I wanted to, you know, first I came forward with the book, and I had gone back to work. I pushed my entire professional life aside for 4 years to try to find a logical source of meaning, and I have yet to find it 15 years later. But I had to go back to work to help put our younger son through medical school. He's now a neurologist, and I was working as the chief clinical consultant of the Wellness and Imaging Center at the Arizona Heart Institute, the renowned Arizona Heart Institute, while I was paring down the book. And when I came forward in 2004 with the book, I have to tell you, Jerry, I had no idea what the reaction was going to be. It was really precarious, not only because I had such a successful medical career and had been out there, you know, imparting poignant messages to kids for the last 35 years on the reality of vital health issues, but I knew in my heart of hearts that I had to impart the reality of this issue if it was that important, and it seemed that important. And when I came forward in 2004, I didn't know what the reaction was going to be. I mean, it was scary, to tell you. And I had done so much soul searching what to do. I wanted to remain anonymous, but I knew if I did, the book would sit on a shelf. And because I've been doing this for so many years, I thought if I could lend that credibility and help get this information out there in a credible way, in a professional way, then how could I not do that, particularly as an educator and certainly as an experiencer as well and as a scientist. So when I came forward, the response, I have to tell you, Jerry, was phenomenal. It was amazing. I had no idea how many people out there, and I have tens of thousands of emails from people appreciating the fact that somebody came forward to say it's okay to talk about this, and there's something out there. I mean, I'm not saying what they are. I don't know what they are. And it's time that we get this out there, and it's time we study it, and it's time we move forward, not only to find out who's driving these things, but certainly in our own evolution, because there is so much more to the story. I mean, it's affected people at such a deep level, not only the Phoenix Lights, but certainly other unexplained phenomena, which I call UPS, unexplained phenomena, because the after effect of these phenomena for those who truly experience it is mind-boggling and world-changing. I mean, it's an enlightenment and an awakening that we're connected. We're connected to the universe, and we're connected to the earth, and we're connected to each other so much more intimately than we could ever imagine. And I think that message is so important to share with people, that we're not alone. We're not alone. And as far as other data, after I came forward with the book, I was approached by filmmakers. And certainly coming from a video and workbook background, I wanted to do a video. But I had no time. I was working 7 to 7 at the Arizona Heart Institute, doing radio programs like this into the night, getting a couple hours sleep, and then doing Barnes & Noble and Borders book tour on the weekend. And actually a couple had, parents had seen me at one of the Barnes & Noble presentations and arranged, surprisingly enough, for me to present the data at a middle school here, a very prestigious middle school. And I was blown away that they could even get that together, because I know how controversial the topic is. But here I walk in the last period of the day, 200 middle school students, you could hear a pin drop. They thirst for this knowledge. And not only that, but I realized for the first time that there is nothing, and I mean zero, nada, in our history books about this topic. And I was approached by filmmakers, one of which, Steve Lance, who was very, very persistent. His parents live here, and he said, I'm coming to see my parents, and I'm bringing the equipment, and we're starting to film in May. And I said, whoa, I said, I don't have time for this. I would love to do it. Plus, I stayed anonymous for 7 years. I don't know if people that had emailed me, witnesses that had emailed me in confidence would come forward, the professors that I worked with at the universities, if they would get involved with this, it's so controversial. Every single person I asked, except one who came on board later, wholeheartedly wanted to do it. And I thought, whoa, this is a sign. I've got to do this, right? So we started production. And by June, by the end of June, it was so overwhelming that I had to make a choice. And it wasn't an easy one, because I loved the job, and it was a wonderful, wonderful job. But here I was in the trenches, really, you know, I mean, getting such incredible information. Anybody that's seen the documentary, I hope appreciates what we're trying to impart, because I tried to cover the whole gamut of the topic in a very gentle way, just as these phenomena are touching people in a very gentle, non-threatening way, one person at a time. I hope that, you know, my book and the documentary do the same, but I had to make a choice, and finally decided to leave the job and to just go full force in finishing the documentary. The first premiere was at the Harkins Scottsdale Theater, and we're having our anniversary, 15th anniversary there as well, March 11th. But we had the premiere there in 2005, and I haven't looked back. We've won over 12 international film festival awards, which is unheard of. I mean, not only for a documentary, but certainly one of the genre. And we keep it keeps evolving with new sightings, with new witnesses coming forward. In fact, interestingly, right after the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights event, our former Governor Symington, who had mocked the sighting in 97, came forward to say that he actually saw it.
Yeah, how do you explain that?
Well, you explain it to me. It's interesting. Well, you know, look, I don't know. I mean, I have to say that initially, and I know the atmosphere at the time in 97 was not the kindest for anyone that came forward. Like I said, the former councilwoman, and she was vice mayor at the time, Frances Barwood, really got blasted. And many of the witnesses that came forward just were nailed to the wall, and there was a lot of criticism and ridicule and laughing and that kind of a thing. Interestingly, too, call it a coincidence, is that in the early 80s, I had done news reporting, health news reporting for NBC in Philadelphia with Jessica Savage, if you remember that name.
Yes.
And I've been
following your career from early on.
You're
quite the TV personality.
Okay.
At one time.
And, well, I'm just trying to help. Just trying to get the information out there in a credible way, and started doing health reporting when we came here to Phoenix at NBC here, and then USA Cable. And any rate, so you know, when you look at the whole picture, and it's funny because the people that I had started working with in the early 80s were just getting started too. A lot of them were underlings at the NBC affiliate here. When I came forward in 2004, you know, they had come a long way. Many of them were the news director or the head of production at another one of the studios. So when I came forward as Dr. X, and I have to tell you, Jim Del Toso and Michael Tanner, the two chief investigators at Village Labs, gave me that name, because I really stayed anonymous. I mean, I let my pictures out there. I let the data out there to speak for itself. I wanted to share it so that people could see what we saw here, but I didn't want anything to do with this. I mean, this isn't about me. It's about the data. And when I did come forward finally, it was amazing because now these people that I had gotten friendly with in the early 80s were heads of the departments at different stations, and they said, "You're Dr. X. Well, come on over." And they have been so kind and so open. And the ridicule and the snickering aren't there. I mean, it's really a model for how the media should react. Just like in Belgium. I mean, Belgium is also a model for what should happen when there's unexplained aerial phenomena sightings. I mean, they joined forces in the 90s with the military and civilians and the university and really tried to find out what was going on. That's what should happen when we have these sightings. And, you know, as far as the governor, I have to tell you, I mean, a lot happened in between 97 and 10 years later.
Yeah.
Including my coming forward. And, you know, I hope, you know, a little bit of my coming forward and people seeing that, you know, if you stand your ground and you have the data and you do your homework, and that's all I ask. All I ask is that people just look at it, and then they can make up their own mind. I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. It's the data is there if people care to look at it. And, you know, maybe he felt that it was time. You know, because things had changed in 10 years.
Well, he used the old, I wanted to avert the panic story.
Well, there wasn't panic. That's the thing. There really wasn't panic.
Well, sometimes, you know, you've been in the media. Sometimes public officials see things that aren't there, especially panic and religion and things like that.
It was curiosity more than anything else.
Yeah, but, right.
You know, if that was his perception, you know, and like I said, it's
well, I'm not buying that, but I mean, I'm just telling you why he said.
Yeah, well, and, you know, and I have to say that, you know, I'm glad that he did come forward. I mean, if my efforts helped him and others to feel brave enough to come forward and share their own stories, well, good for him. It certainly helped move ability of the sighting forward, and for that, I really appreciate that, because to have an elected official divulge that he saw something that, in his estimation as a pilot and past military, was not of our world is a giant step forward, I think.
And we're almost out of time. I want to run down what's happening in March, April, and May with you.
Well, the other thing that I'm doing, you asked me what other things I'm doing. I'm going back to my passion of youth education, and now that the book and the documentary have kind of gotten a life of their own, I am certainly speaking and worldwide on the topic. I'm going with the flow and wherever it leads me, just trying to help. But I'm also working on a curriculum, a comprehensive curriculum called Out of the Box, that will address unexplained phenomena. And we're talking in a very, again, a very gentle overview of the topic, addressing crop circles and introducing crop circles in mathematics as well as art, the history timeline, working with some wonderful people, Richard Dolan and Dr. Bruce Maccabee, with the history of this topic, which is extensive, as well as the science. We have a classroom now where we have a pilot program where half the class is building a space station and half the class is building an underwater station, with the question, you know, what if we can't survive here anymore on Earth? What would we do? How would we survive? And also bringing up the questions in English class, what if we're not alone in the universe? How would that change our worldview? How would that change our world? What would we tell them about us? I mean, so many different issues just to introduce this topic. Because, again, kids thirst for this knowledge. They want to know about this. I mean, they're watching all the shows on cable, Ancient Aliens and UFO Hunters and all that. I mean, they're watching this stuff, and they are really curious, and they want to know more. And certainly the more credible information we can give them, the better. And that's what I'm trying to do. So we have a pilot program working with wonderful teachers, working with an ASU senior math professor on the crop circles and so forth, to really get something credible and wonderful into the classroom for 5th to 12th grade. And that's what I'm working on now. I have an event coming up on March 11th, which is the 15th anniversary of the mass sighting celebration at the Scottsdale Harkin Shea Theater at 1 p.m. on Sunday, March 11th. And it's been sold out ever since the premiere in 2005. So, you know, if this is timely, I hope that people get their tickets early through the Harkins Movie Theater. It's a wonderful, wonderful event. I mean, not only do we screen the documentary, and I have to say, people walk in as strangers, but leave connected. There is something that happens within those few hours that we're there, because we show the documentary, then we have we introduce the cast members that are there, and this year Francis Barwood and a number of other wonderful cast members will be there, and we'll also be doing a little presentation, and Steve Lance, my collaborator on the film, will be in town to host the Q&A, and I'll be doing a little presentation as well and a book signing. So it's a really amazing event, and we usually have standing room only. People try to push their way into standing in the back, and it's great fun. So I hope.
And tickets are still available.
Tickets are still available, and also again, call, you know, to give the theater a call or go online for Harkins Theater. And I'm also speaking at a very unique conference. Paula Harris has organized the first annual 2012 Women's Symposium in Glen Rose, Texas.
Yeah, I had to look that up and see where Glen Rose was. It's just south
really,
of Fort Worth.
Yeah, it should be really, really interesting. There's men there, too, and there's going to be witnesses from the Stephenville, Texas sighting, which is very similar, by the way, to the Phoenix lights, and I'll be addressing that at that conference. We'll be doing a panel. So there'll be men and women, but as far as the women, the presenters, we have Carol Rosin, and we have Angelina Joyner, who was the journalist that actually broke the story for the Phoenix, for the Stephenville sighting, as well as Paula Harris and a number of other wonderful speakers. So it should be really fun, and that's May the 19th and 20th. In Texas. And if you look on StarWorksUSA.com, it's listed there, or go to my website, the Phoenix Lights Network, and go to the events page, and we have a link there, and to other events that are coming up as well.
We're going to have to end it here, but there's lots of questions that need to be asked, and I'm sure you're still investigating and you still have lots of answers that I haven't gotten around to.
Like I said, it was a 750-page journal, and a lot more has come out in the last 15 years.
Yeah, so, right.
You know, I urge people to just, you know, take a look at the book, The Phoenix Lights, The Skeptics' Discovery That We Are Not Alone. I also have and the documentary, The Phoenix Lights, We Are Not Alone documentary. And the bonus features, by the way, are wonderful. We have Dr. Edgar Mitchell, astronaut. Dr. Edgar Mitchell is in the documentary, and he is just amazing. I mean, he by the way, was being conferred with during the mass sighting, and he talks about that and also about the cover-up, the government cover-up in the bonus features, also the coincidences, which we never even got to. There are some really bizarre coincidences that happened on March 13th, including a satellite that is supposed to detect incoming missiles went dead that night. It was built out in Chandler here, and we got the word that it went dead that night. Plus, there was an article in the July issue of Scientific America, that there were strange gamma rays coming into our atmosphere on March 13th. Didn't mention the Phoenix Lights, of course, but it's there nonetheless. And also, you know, I got the word that we went to DEFCON 3. I don't know if that's true. It's, you know, certainly speculation, but those are the coincidences that were brought up by some of the investigators here. So there's a lot more to this story, so I really hope people do pick up the book and get in contact with me if they like. And I also have a page on Facebook, Phoenix Lights Network page, and I post a lot of interesting information there as well if people want to join us there.
When I started covering this story originally, I figured it was an extraterrestrial period. Now, I don't know, especially after listening to you and reading your stuff and watching your videos, there must be more to it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, Jerry, I don't know what they are. I just know that they are. I mean, we can speculate that they're spirit world, as the native cultures think, that they're time travelers, that they're interstellar, interdimensional, or all of the above. I mean, we know that...
I'm inclined to think a lot of these things are always ending up being all of the above or most of the above.
Right, right. Well, you know, the universe is probably teeming with life when you really look at the data. I mean, our one galaxy, and we know now that there are billions of galaxies out there, you know, with the Hubble and the Kepler now, that mm-hmm. might have trillions of planets, and a certain percentage livable. And certainly we know that the ingredients for life are out there, amino acids and so forth. So, you know, when you look at our one Milky Way galaxy, it's about 14 to 16 billion years old. Our one solar system is 4 to 6 billion years old. There could actually be sentient, intelligent beings out there billions of years ahead of us, billions of years ahead of us. So, you know, when you take that in consideration and, you know, how they may have found a way to be here while we're talking right now, and we don't see them unless, again, we're open to them or get glimpses of them. But I think we're getting to that point, Jerry, and I hope we are.
The thing that bothers me about it, I'm inclined to agree with you on all of this about the hidden meanings, the spiritual world, or whatever, the other dimensional aspects, time traveling, and all of that. But why would the government be so obfuscational in not telling the truth about any of this stuff? They must know something.
Well, that's a really good question, Jerry. And I have, you know, I no longer even ask it anymore because
I understand.
That's, you know, they have a job to do too. There must be a reason. Certainly, other countries are much more open to these phenomena as being.
I think it's outmoded thinking on the part of our politicians.
Well, I think they know.
What it is the same thing that Fife Symington said. He probably believed it. Maybe giving the benefit of the doubt, it would cause panic. And we hear that about UFOs all the time. Well, we can't. That's going to upset all religions. Mm-hmm. All of that is BS. Everybody would be adapting and changing their narrative to all of the religions of the world within 2 weeks.
You make a really, really good point. And, you know, J. Allen Hynek, who was plucked from the head of the astronomy department at Northwestern to head Project Blue Book, which we know is the only,
yes,
you know, public study of UFOs, and that where most things were brushed under the carpet that were actually real, and they let out the things that weren't, that could be easily explained. Right before he passed, not only did he share that he was told to put a lid on any kind of panic, which is understandable at the time with the Cold War and all that, but he also said very poignantly that science happens in threes. The first stage is complete disbelief. The second stage is, well, it might be so. And the third and final stage is, I knew it all the time. And I think we're getting closer and closer to that final stage. I think we've been really fed enough mis- and disinformation for decades that, you know, now that we have seen, I mean, now with technology, certainly the internet and social networking gets sightings out there at a heartbeat. I mean, I have people on my Facebook page reporting sightings as they're happening, which is phenomenal. We have cell phones now, which we didn't in 97, by the way. I mean, very few people had cell phones, and those, they were big. They didn't have cameras. But now we have cameras and cell phones, so people can actually capture these phenomena, and most can be explained. Most can be explained. But, and that's why you have to be discerning and prudent when there are sightings, and certainly there's, you know, so much hoaxing going on the internet too, which is another side of this, which is unpleasant. But, the bottom line is that more and more people are being touched by these things one person at a time. They're seeing things that are real to them, that are unexplainable, they cannot be denied any longer. And I think that, you know, this is really going to come from the people. I mean, as far as, you know, it's wonderful that there are others out there trying to get the government and military to come forward with information. But on the other side, and I really feel personally that that's my part in this, is to help people learn and to grow and to be prepared. Because who's preparing the public, really, Jerry? Who's preparing the public? And that's one of the reasons I'm doing the curriculum, is because, you know, perhaps we won't see it in our lifetime, but certainly the next generation is going to see more and more of these phenomena, because they're increasing, and they can't be brushed off any longer. So it's time we do prepare the population. And I agree with you. I mean, there are some people that are going to freak out. There's no doubt about it. But I think the vast amount of people worldwide now, because we have become so small with social networking and so forth, are quite aware that something's going on. Something's going on. And that there's an intelligence, beyond our own that's visiting us and that's here. And, you know, again, it's a choice. We have free will, and it's a choice of people whether to open up to that and learn about it, because the more you learn about it, the more you feel comfortable and the less you fear. And, you know, I think that's what this is about, too, that we need to get past that and to move forward and to address it address the reality in a credible and realistic way.
I think that's a good way to leave the show.
All righty then. Hey, Jerry, thank you so much for letting me share. I know we went over a lot of things, and it is confusing. I mean, it isn't an easy topic, but when you look at how the Phoenix Lights event transformed and really look at the puzzle pieces and the reality of really what happened here that affected thousands and thousands of people at such a deep level, and it's still affecting people at a very deep level, and it's affecting people worldwide. In fact, when I came forward in 2004, I'll leave you with this, Jerry, the official and accepted explanation of the Phoenix Lights, because that was all that was out there, and anybody not here locally didn't know the rest of the story, was that the Phoenix Lights were merely military illumination flares. And that's what was accepted. And you can only imagine the angst and the frustration for someone like myself that knew that there was so much more to this story that needed to be heard. And I'm so glad that it is being heard, and that people are embracing the data and just looking at it. I mean, it's data, it's information, it's important tidbits that can really give the picture of something real and wondrous, and the possibilities are wondrous. And now when similar sightings are occurring worldwide, they compare them to the Phoenix Lights, and that's really cool.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lim. We'll talk to you later.
Talk to you soon. Thanks so much, too.
We'll have to do this more often.